flustered in the Duke's council chamber at the thought of speaking before the Elf Queen, who now speaks the true tongue as if born to it? He pushed away her hand gently. I am what I am, what you see. His voice was firm, commanding. She studied his face, holding back a shudder as she recognized something fearful within his countenance. But what do I see, Thomas? Ignoring her question, he said, Why do you avoid me, lady? Gently she spoke. There is this thing growing between us that may not be. It sprang into existence the moment you first came to us, Thomas. Almost with a note of amusement, Thomas said, Before that, lady, from the first I gazed upon you. He stood tall over her. And why may this thing not be? Who better to sit at your side? She moved away from him, her control lost for a brief moment. In that instant, he saw what few had ever seen. The Elf Queen confused and unsure, doubting her own ancient wisdom. Whatever else, you are man. Despite what powers are granted you, it is a man's span allotted to you. I will reign until my spirit travels to the Blessed Isles to be with my lord, who has already made the journey. Then Caelin rules, as son of a king, as king. Thus it is with my people. Thomas reached for her and turned her to face him. It was not always so. Her eyes showed a spark of fear. No, we were not always a free people. She sensed impatience within him, but she also saw him struggle with it as he forced his voice to calmness. Do you then feel nothing? She took a step away. I would lie if I said not, but it is a strange pulling, and something that fills me with uncertainty and with no small dread. If you become more the Valhuru, more than the man can master, then we could not welcome you here. We would not allow the return of the old ones. Thomas laughed with a strange mixture of humor and bitterness. As a boy, I beheld you and was filled with a boy's longing. Now I am a man and behold you with a man's longing. Is the power that makes me bold enough to seek you out, the power that gives me the means to do so, that which will also keep us apart? Aglarana put her hand to her cheek. I know not. It has never been with the royal family to be other than what we are. Others may seek alliance with humans. I would not have that sadness when you are old and grey, and I am still as you see me. Thomas's eyes flashed, and his voice gained a harsh edge. That will never happen, lady. I shall live 1,000 years in this glade. Of that I have no doubt. But I shall trouble you no more, until other matters are settled. This thing is willed by fate to be, Aglarana. You will come to know that. She stood with her hand raised to her mouth, and her eyes moist with emotion. He walked away, leaving her alone in her court to consider what he had said. For the first time since her Lord King had passed over, Aglarana knew two conflicting emotions, fear and longing. Thomas turned at a shout from the edge of the clearing. An elf was walking from the trees, followed by a simply dressed man. He stopped his conversation with Caelin and Dolgan, and the three hurried to follow the stranger as he was guided up to the queen's court. Aglarana sat on her throne, her elders arranged on benches to either side. T'Thar stood next to the queen. The stranger approached the throne and made a slight bow. T'Thar threw a quick glance at the sentry who had escorted the man, but the elf looked bemused. The man in brown said,
Greetings, lady,
in perfect elvish. Aglarana answered in the king's tongue,
You come boldly among us, stranger.
The man smiled, leaning on his staff.
Still, I did seek a guide, for I would not enter Elvander unbidden.
Tathar said, I think yon guide had little choice. The man said,
There is always a choice, though it is not always apparent.
Thomas stepped forward. What is your purpose here? Turning at the voice, the man smiled.
Ah, the wearer of the dragon's gift. Well met, Thomas of Cridy.
Thomas stepped back. The man's eyes radiated power, and his easy manner veiled strength that Thomas could feel.
Who are you?
The man said,
I have many names, but here I am called Macross the Black.
He pointed with his staff and swept it around the gathered watchers.
I have come, for you have embarked upon a bold plan.
At the last, he pointed his staff at Thomas. He dropped the tip and leaned on the staff again.
But the plan to capture a black robe will bring naught but destruction to Elvander, should you not have my aid.
He smiled slightly.
A black robe you shall have in time, but not yet.
There was a hint of irony in his voice. Aglarana arose. Her shoulders were back, and her eyes looked straight into his.
You know much.
Macross inclined his head slightly.
I know much, more than is sometimes comforting.
He stepped past her and placed a hand upon Thomas's shoulder. Guiding Thomas to a seat near where the queen stood, Macross forced him to sit with a gentle pressure on his shoulder. He took a seat next to him and laid the staff against the crook of his neck and shoulder. Looking at the queen, he said,
The Surani come at first light, and they will drive straight through to Elvander.
Tathar stepped before Macross and said, How do you know this? Macross smiled again.
Do you not remember me in council with your father?
Tathar stepped back, his eyes widening.
You? I am he, though I am no longer called as I was then.
Tathar looked troubled.
So long ago, I would not have thought it possible.
Macross said,
Much is possible.
He looked pointedly from the queen to Thomas. Aglarana slowly sat down, masking her discomfort.
Are you the sorcerer?
Macross nodded.
So I am called, though there is more in the tale than can be told now. Will you heed me?
Tathar nodded to the queen.
Long ago, this one came to our aid. I do not understand how it can be the same man, but he was then a true friend to your father and mine. He can be trusted. What, then, is your counsel?
Asked the queen.
The Surani magicians have marked your sentries, knowing where they hide. At first light they will come, breaking across the river in two waves, like the horns of a bull. As you meet them, a wave of the creatures called Choja will come through the center, where your strength is weak. They have not thrown them against you yet, but the dwarves can tell you of their skill in warfare.
Dolgan stepped forward.
Aye, lady, they are fearsome creatures and fight in the dark as well as do my people. I had thought them confined to the mines.
Macross said,
And so they were, until the raids. They have brought up a host of them, which ready themselves across the river, beyond the sight of your scouts. They will come in numbers. The Surani tire of your raids and would put an end to the warring across the river. Their magicians have worked hard to learn the secrets of Elvander, and now they know that should the sacred heart of the elven forests fall, the elves will be a force no longer.
Thomas said, Then we shall hold back and defend against the center. Macross sat quietly for a moment, as if remembering something.
That is a start. But they bring their magicians with them, anxious as they are for an ending. Their magic will let their warriors pass through your forests unchecked by the power of your spellweavers, and here they will come.
Aglarana said,
Then we shall meet them here and stand until the end.
Macross nodded.
Bravely said, lady, but you will need my aid.
Dolgan studied the sorcerer.
What can one man do?
Macross stood.
Much. Upon the morrow, you shall see. Fear not, dwarf, the battle will be harsh, and many will travel to the Blessed Isles, but with firm resolve, we shall prevail.
Thomas said, You speak like one who has already seen these things happen. Macross smiled, and his eyes said a thousand things and nothing.
I do, Thomas of Cridy, do I not?
He turned to the others and with a sweep of his staff said,
Ready yourselves. I shall be with you.
To the queen he said,
I would rest, if you have a place for me.
The queen turned to the elf who had brought Macross to the council.
Take him to a room. Bring him whatever he requires.
The sorcerer bowed and followed the guide. The others stood in silence until Thomas said,
Let us make ready.
As night gave way to dawn, the queen stood alone near her throne. In all the years of her rule, she had never known a time like this. Her thoughts ran with hundreds of images, from times as long ago as her youth, and as recently as two nights ago.
Seeking answers in the past, lady?
She turned to see the sorcerer standing behind her, leaning on his staff. He approached and stood next to her.
Can you read my mind, sorcerer?
With a smile and a wave of his hand, Macross said,
No, my lady, but there is much I do know and can see. Your heart is heavy, and your mind burdened. Do you understand why?
Macross laughed softly.
Without question. Still, I would speak to you of these things. Why, sorcerer? What part do you play?
Macross looked out over the lights of Elvander.
A part much as any man plays. But you know yours well.
True.
It is given to some to understand what is obscure to others. Such is my fate. Why have you come? Because there is need. Without me, Elvander may fall, and that must not be. It is so ordained, and I can only do my part. Will you stay if the battle is won?
No.
I have other tasks, but I will come once more, when the need is again great.
When?
That I may not tell you. Will it be soon?
Soon enough, though not soon enough.
You speak in riddles.
Macross smiled, a crooked, sad smile.
Life is a riddle. It is in the hands of the gods. Their will shall prevail, and many mortals will find their lives changed. Thomas?
Aglarana looked deep into the sorcerer's dark eyes.
He most visibly, but all who live through these times. What is he?
What would you have him be?
The elf queen found herself unable to answer. Macross placed his hand lightly on her shoulder. She felt calm flow from his fingers and heard herself say,
I would wish nothing of trouble upon my people. But the sight of him fills me with longing. I long for a man with his might. Thomas is more like my lost lord than he will ever know, and I fear him, for once I make the pledge,
Once I place him above me, I lose the power to rule. Do you think the elders would allow this? My people would never willingly place the yoke of the Valhuru upon their necks again.
The sorcerer was silent for a time, then said,
For all my arts, there are things hidden from me. But understand this, there is a magic here fay beyond imagining. I cannot explain, save to say it reaches across time, more than is apparent. For while the Valhuru is present within Thomas now, so is Thomas present within the Valhuru in ages past. Thomas wears the garb of Ashen Sugar, last of the Dragon Lords. When the Chaos Wars raged, he alone remained upon this world, for he felt things alien to his kind. Thomas?
Macross smiled.
Think not upon this overly long, lady. These sorts of paradox can send the mind reeling. What Ashensugar felt was an obligation to protect this world.
Aglarana studied Macross's face in the twinkling lights of Elvanda.
You know more of the ancient lore than any other man, sorcerer. I have been given much, lady.
He looked over the elven forests and spoke more to himself than to the queen.
Soon will come a time of testing for Thomas. I cannot be sure what will occur, but this much I do know. Somehow the boy from Crydee, in his love for you and yours, in his simple human caring, has so far withstood the most powerful member of the most powerful mortal race ever to have lived upon this world. And he is well served in withstanding the terrible pain of that conflict of two natures by the soft arts of your spellweavers.
She looked hard at Macross.
You know of this?
He laughed with genuine amusement.
Lady, I am not without some vanity. I'm stung you'd think you could fashion so fine a spellweaving without my observing. Little magic in this world escapes my notice. What you have done is wise and may tip the balance in Thomas's favor. That is the thought I plead to myself,
said Aglarana quietly.
When I see in Thomas a lord to match the king of my youth, the husband taken too soon from my side, can it be true? Should he survive the time of testing, yes. It may be the conflict will prove the end of both Thomas and Ashensugar. But should Thomas survive, he may become what you most secretly long for. Now I shall tell you something only the gods and I know. I can judge many things yet to come, but much is still unknown to me. One thing I know is this. At your side, Thomas may grow to rule wisely and well, and, as his youth is replaced by wisdom, grow to be the lord of your wishes, if his power can somehow be tempered by his human heart. Should he be sent away, a terrible fate may await both the kingdom and the free peoples of the West.
Her eyes asked the question, and he continued.
I cannot see into that dark future, lady. I can only surmise. Should he come into his powers with the dark side in preeminence, he will be a terrible force, one that must be destroyed. Those who see the battle madness come upon him see but a shadow of the true darkness bound up within him. Even if a balance is struck, and Thomas's humanity survives, but still you send him away, then humanity's capacity for anger, pain, and hate may come forth. I ask you, should Thomas be driven away and some day raise the dragon standard in the north, what would occur?
The queen became frightened and openly showed it, her mask of control lost completely.
The Moridhel would gather. Aye, my lady. Not as bands of troublesome bandits,
but as a host. 20,000 Dark Brothers, and with them 100,000 goblins, and companies of men whose dark nature would seek profit in the destruction and savagery to follow. A mighty army under the steel glove of a warrior born, a general whom even your own people follow without question. Do you advise me to keep him here? I can only point out the alternatives. You must decide.
The Elf Queen threw back her head, her red gold locks flying and her eyes moist, looking out over Elvander. The first light of day was breaking. Rosy light lanced through the trees, casting shadows of deep blue. The morning songs of birds could be heard around the glades. She turned to Macross, wishing to thank him for his counsel, and found him gone. The Surani advanced as Macross had foretold. The Choja attacked across the river after the two human waves had carried the flanks. Thomas had set skirmishers, lines of bowmen with a few shield guards, who retreated and fired into the advancing army, giving the impression of resistance. Thomas stood before the assembled army of Elvander and the dwarves of the Grey Towers, only 1,500 arrayed against the 6,000 invaders and their magicians. In silence, they waited. As the enemy approached, the shouts of Surani warriors and the cries of those who fell to elvish arrows could be heard through the forest. Thomas looked up at the queen, standing on a balcony, overlooking the scene of the coming battle, next to the sorcerer. Suddenly, elves were running toward them, and the first flashes of brightly colored Surani armor could be seen through the trees. When the skirmishers had rejoined the main force, Thomas raised his sword.
"Wait!"
a voice cried out from above, and the sorcerer pointed across the open clearing, where the first elements of the Surani forces were running into the clearing. Confronted by the waiting elven army, the vanguard halted and waited as their comrades joined them. Their officers ordered ranks formed, for here was fighting they could understand, two armies meeting on an open plain, and the advantage was theirs. The Choja also stood in ordered ranks, heeding the officers' shouted commands. Thomas was fascinated, for he still knew little of these creatures and counted them animals as much as intelligent allies of the Surani. Macross shouted, "Wait!" again, and waved his staff above his head, inscribing broad circles in the air. A stillness descended upon the glade. Suddenly an owl flew past Thomas's head, straight for the Surani lines. It circled above the aliens for a moment, then swooped and struck a soldier in the face. The man screamed in pain as its talons clawed his eyes. A hawk sped past and duplicated the owl's attack. Then a large black rook descended from the sky. A flight of sparrows erupted from the trees behind the Surani and pecked at faces and unprotected arms. Birds came flying from every part of the forest and attacked the invaders. Soon the air was filled with the sound of flapping wings as every manner of bird in the forest descended upon the Surani. Thousands of them, from the smallest hummingbird to the mighty eagle, attacked the outworld host. Men cried out, and a few broke formation and ran, trying to avoid the wicked beaks and talons that tried to scratch at eyes, pull at cloaks, and tear flesh. The Choja reared, for though their armored hide was immune to the pecking and clawing, their large, jewel-like eyes were easy targets for the feathered attackers. A shout went up from the elves as the Surani lines dissolved in disorder. Thomas gave the order, and elven bowmen added feathered arrows to the fray. Surani soldiers were struck and fell before they could come to grips with the enemy. Their own bowmen could not return the fire, for they were harried by 100 tiny foes. The elves watched as the Surani tried to hold position, while the birds continued their bloody work in their midst. The Surani fought back as best they could, striking down many birds in mid-flight. but for each one killed, three took its place. Suddenly a hissing, tearing sound cut through the din. There was an instant of silence as everything moving on the Serrani side of the clearing seemed to pause. Then the birds exploded upward, accompanied by a sizzling crackle of energy, as if thrown back by some unseen force. As the birds cleared the area, Thomas could see the black robes of the Serrani magicians as they moved through their forces, restoring order. Hundreds of wounded Serrani lay upon the ground, but the battle-tempered aliens quickly reformed their lines, ignoring the injured. The enormous flight of birds gathered again above the invaders and started to dive. Instantly, a glowing red shield of energy formed around the Serrani. As the birds struck, they stiffened and fell, their feathers smoldering and filling the air with a pungent, burning stench. Elven arrows that struck the barrier were halted in mid-flight and burst into flame, falling harmlessly to the ground. Thomas gave the order to stop the bow fire and turned to look at Macross. Again, the sorcerer shouted, "Wait!" Macross waved his staff and the birds dispersed, hearing his silent command. The staff extended toward the Serrani as Macross aimed it at the red barrier. A golden bolt of energy shot forth. It sped across the clearing and pierced the red barrier to strike a black-robed magician in the chest. The magician crumpled to the ground, and a shout of horror and outrage went up from the assembled Serrani. The other magicians turned their attention to the platform above the elven army, and blue globes of fire shot toward Macross. Thomas shouted, "Aglarana!" in rage as the tiny blue star struck the platform, obliterating all sight of her in a blinding display of exploding light. Then he could see again. The sorcerer stood upon the platform unharmed, as did the queen. Tathar pulled her away, and Macross pointed with his staff again. Another black-robed magician fell. The four remaining magicians looked upon Macross's survival and counterattack with expressions of mixed awe and anger, clearly seen across the glade. They redoubled their assault upon the sorcerer, wave after wave of blue light and fire striking Macross's protective barrier. All upon the ground were forced to turn away from the sight, lest they become blinded by the terrible energies being unleashed. After this magical onslaught was ended, Thomas looked upward, and again the sorcerer was unharmed. One magician gave out with a cry of pure anguish and pulled a device from his robe. Activating it, he vanished from the clearing, followed moments later by his three companions. Macross looked down at Thomas, pointed his staff at the Serrani host, and called, "Now!" Thomas raised his sword and gave the signal to attack. A hail of arrows passed overhead as he led the charge across the clearing. The Serrani were demoralized, their attack blunted by the birds and the sight of their magicians being killed and driven off. Yet they stood their ground and took the charge. Hundreds had died from the claws and beaks of the birds, and more from the flights of arrows. But still they numbered 3-1 of the elves and dwarves. The battle was joined, and Thomas was caught up in the red haze that washed away any thought but to kill. Hacking right and left, he carved a path through the Serrani, confounding their every attempt to strike him down. Serrani and Chocha both fell to his blade, as he delivered death with an even hand to all who stood before him. Back and forth across the clearing, the battle moved, as man and Chocha, elf and dwarf, fell. The sun moved higher in the sky, and there was no respite from the fray. The sounds of death filled the air, and high overhead the kites and vultures gathered. Slowly the Serrani press forced the elves and dwarves back. Slowly they moved toward the heart of Elvander. There was a brief pause, as if Both sides had struck a balance when the adversaries moved away from each other, leaving an open space between. Thomas heard the voice of the sorcerer ringing clear above the sounds of battle. "Back!" it cried. And to a man, the forces of Elvander retreated. The Serrani paused a moment, then, sensing the hesitation of the elves and dwarves to continue, started to press forward. Abruptly there came a rumbling sound and the earth trembled. All stopped moving, and the Serrani looked fearful. Thomas could see the trees shake, more and more violently, as the trembling increased. Suddenly there came a crescendo of noise, as if the grandfather of all thunderclaps pealed overhead. With the booming sound, a huge piece of earth erupted upward, as if heaved by some invisible giant's hand. The Serrani who were standing on it shot upward, to fall hard to the ground, and those nearby were knocked aside. Another piece of the ground erupted, then a third. Suddenly the air was full of giant pieces of earth that flew upward, then fell upon the Serrani. Screams of terror filled the air, and the Serrani turned and fled. There was no order to their retreat, for they flew from a place where the very earth attacked them. Thomas watched as the clearing was emptied of all but the dead and dying. In a matter of minutes, the clearing was quiet as the earth subsided and the shocked onlookers stood mute. The sounds of the Serrani army retreating through the woods could be heard. Their cries told of other horrors being visited upon them as they fled. Thomas felt weak and weary, and looked down to find his arms covered with blood. His tabard and shield and his golden sword were clean as they always were, but for the first time he could feel human life splattered upon himself. In Elvander, the battle madness did not stay with him, and he felt sick to his inner being. He turned and said softly, "It is over." There was a faint cheer from the elves and dwarves, but it was half-hearted, for none felt like victors. They had seen a mighty host felled by primeval forces, elemental powers that defied description. Thomas walked slowly past Cailin and Dolgan and mounted the stairs. The elf prince sent soldiers to follow the retreating invaders, to care for the allied wounded, and to give the dying Serrani quick mercy. Thomas made his way to the small room where he abided and pulled aside the curtain. He sat heavily upon his pallet, tossing aside his sword and shield. A dull throbbing in his head caused him to close his eyes. Memories came flooding in. The heavens were torn with mad vortices of energy crashing from horizon to horizon. Ashen Sugar sat upon mighty Sharuga's back, watching the very fabric of time and space rent. A clarion rang, the heralding note heard by dint of his magic. The moment he awaited had come. Urging Sharuga upward, Ashen Sugar's eyes searched the heavens, seeking what must come against the mad display in the skies. A sudden stiffening of Sharuga under him coincided with his sighting of his prey. The figure of Draken Corin grew recognizable as he sat upon his black dragon. There was a strangeness in his eyes, and for the first time in his long memory, Ashen Sugar began to understand the meaning of horror. He could not put a name to it, could not describe it, but in the tortured eyes of Draken Corin, he saw it. Ashen Sugar ordered Sharuga forward. The mighty golden dragon roared his challenge, answered by Draken Corin's equally mighty black. The two clashed in the sky, and their riders worked their arts upon each other. Ashen Sugar's golden blade arched overhead and struck, cleaving the black shield with the grinning tiger's head in twain. It was almost too easy, as Ashen Sugar had known it would be. Draken Corrin had given up too much of his essence to that which was forming. Before the might of the last Valhorru, he was little more than a mortal. Once, twice, three times more, ashen sugar struck, and the last of his brothers fell from the back of his black dragon. Downward he tumbled to strike the ground. By force of will, Ashen Sugar left Sharuga's back and floated to stand beside the helpless body of Draken Corrin, leaving Sharuga to finish his contest with the near-dead black dragon. A spark of life still persisted within the broken form, life ages past remembering. A pleading look entered Draken Corrin's eyes as Ashen Sugar approached. He whispered, "Why?" Pointing heavenward with his golden blade, Ashen Sugar said, "This obscenity should never have been allowed. You bring an end to all we know." Draken Corrin looked skyward to where Ashen Sugar pointed. He watched the tumbling, raging display of energies, twisted, screaming rainbows of light jagged across the vault of the sky. He witnessed the new horror being formed from the twisted life force of his brothers and sisters, a raging, mindless thing of hate and anger. In a croaking voice, Draken Corrin said, "They were so strong, we could never have dreamed." His face contorted in terror and hate as Ashen Sugar raised his golden blade. "But I had the right," he screamed. Ashen Sugar brought down his blade, cleanly severing the head of Draken Corrin from his body. At once, both head and body were engulfed with a glimmering light, and the air hissed around Ashen Sugar. Then the fallen Valhorru vanished without trace, his essence returning to that mindless monster raging against the new gods. With bitterness, Ashen Sugar said, "There is no right. There is only power." "Is that how it was?" "Yes. That is how I slew the last of my brethren." "The others?" "They are now part of that." He indicated the terrible sky. Together, never apart, they watched the madness above as the chaos wars raged. After a time, Ashen Sugar said, "Come, this is an ending. Let us be done with it." They began to walk toward the waiting Sharuga. Then a voice came. "You are quiet." Thomas opened his eyes. Before him knelt Aglarana, a basin of herb-sweetened water and a cloth in her hand. She removed his tabard and helped him pull off the golden chain. While he sat near exhaustion, she began washing the blood from his face and arms, saying nothing as he watched her. When he was clean, she took a dry cloth to his face and said, "You look tired, my lord." "I see many things, Aglarana, things not meant for a man to see. I bear the weight of ages upon my soul, and I am tired." "Is there no comfort to be sought?" He looked at her, their eyes locking. The commanding gaze was tempered by a hint of gentleness, but still she was forced to drop her eyes. "Do you mock me, lady?" She shook her head. "No, Thomas, I came to comfort you, if you have need." He reached out and took her hand and drew her toward him, hunger in his eyes. When she was encircled by his embrace, feeling the rising passion in his body, she heard him say, "My need is great, lady." Looking into his pale eyes, she dropped the final barriers between them. "As is mine, my lord." Chapter 4. Training. He arose in the darkness. He donned a simple white robe, a mark of his station, and left his cell. He waited outside the small and simple room, which contained a sleeping mat, a single candle, and a shelf for scrolls, all that was deemed necessary for his education. Down the corridor he could see the others, all years younger than he, standing quietly before the doors of their cells. The first black-clad master came along the corridor and stopped before one of the others. Without a word, the man nodded. The boy fell in behind him, and they marched away into the gloom. The dawn sent soft grey light through the high, narrow windows in the hallway. He, like the others, extinguished the torch on the wall opposite his door at the first hint of day. Another man in black came down the corridor, and another waiting youth left behind him. Soon a third, then a fourth. After a time, he found himself alone. The hallway was silent. A figure emerged from the darkness, his robes conspiring to mask his coming until the last few feet. He stood before the young man in white and nodded, pointing down the corridor. The youth fell in behind his black-robed guide, and they made their way down a series of torch-lit passages into the heart of the great building that had been the young man's home as long as he could remember. Soon they were travelling through a series of low tunnels, rank with the smell of age and wet, as if deep below the lake that surrounded the building on all sides. The man in black paused at a wooden door, slid a bolt aside, and opened it. The younger man entered behind the older and came to stand before a series of wooden troughs. Each was half the length of a man's height, and half that wide. One stood on the floor, and the others were arrayed above it, suspended by wooden supports in steps, one above the next, until the highest stood near the height of a man's head. All of those above had single holes in the end that overhung the trough below. In the bottom trough, water could be heard sloshing as it responded to the vibrations of their footfalls on the stone floor. The man in black pointed to a bucket and turned and left the young man in white alone. The young man picked up the bucket and set about his task. All commands to those in white were given without words, and, as he had quickly learned when he had first become aware, those in white were not allowed to speak. He knew he could speak, for he understood the concept and had quietly tried to form a few words while lying on his mat in the dark. As with so many other things, he understood the fact without being aware of how he understood. He knew that he existed before his first awakening in his cell, but was not in the least alarmed by his lack of memory. It seemed somehow proper. He started his task. Like so many other things he was commanded to do, it seemed an impossible undertaking. He took the bucket and filled the topmost trough from the bottom one. As it had on days before, the water spilled from the top down into each successive trough, until the contents of the bucket rested again at the bottom. Doggedly, he pursued his work, letting his mind go vacant, while his body undertook the mindless task. As it did so many other times when left to its own devices, his mind danced from image to image. Bright flashes of shapes and colors eluded his grasp as he sought to close mental fingers around them. First came a brief glimpse of a beach with crashing waves on rocks, black and weathered. Fighting. A strange-looking cold white substance lying on the ground, a word, snow, that fled as quickly as it came. A muddy camp. A great kitchen with boys hurrying about many tasks. A room in a high tower. Each passed with blinding quickness, leaving only an afterimage in its passing. Daily a voice would sound in his head, and his mind's voice would respond with an answer while he labored at his endless task. The voice would ask a simple question, and his mind's voice would answer. Should the answer be incorrect, the question would be repeated. If several wrong answers were made, the voice would cease its questioning, sometimes returning later in the day, sometimes not. The white-clad worker felt the familiar pressure against the fabric of his thoughts.
"What is the law?" the voice asked.
"The law is the structure that surrounds our lives and gives them meaning," he answered.
"What is the highest embodiment of the law?"
"The Empire is the highest embodiment of the law."
"What are you?"
came the next question. "I am a servant of the Empire." The thought contact flickered for a moment, then returned, as if the other were considering the following question carefully.
"In what manner are you allowed to serve?"
The question had been asked several times before, and always his answer had been met with the blank inner silence that told him he had answered incorrectly. This time he carefully considered, eliminating all the answers he had made previously, as well as those that were combinations of extrapolations of the previously incorrect ones. Finally he answered, "As I see fit." There was a surge of feeling from without, a feeling of approval. Quickly, another question followed.
"Where is your allotted place?"
He thought about this, knowing that the obvious answer was likely to be the incorrect one, but still one that needed to be tested. He answered,
"My place is here."
The mind contact was broken, as he suspected it would be. He knew that he was being trained, though the purpose of the training was masked from his mind. Now he could ponder the last question in light of his previous answers and perhaps ascertain the correct response. That night he dreamed. A strange man in a brown robe, tied with a whipcord belt, walked along the roadway. The man in brown turned and said,
"Hurry up! We don't have much time, and you can't fall behind."
He tried to move faster, but found his feet were lead and his arms tied to his sides. The man in brown halted his brisk walk and said,
"Very well, then. One thing at a time."
He tried to speak and found his mouth refused to move. The man in brown stroked his beard thoughtfully, then said,
"Consider this. You are the architect of your own imprisonment."
He looked down and saw that his bare feet were upon a dusty road. He looked up, and the man in brown was again walking briskly away. He tried to follow, and again couldn't move. He awoke in a cold sweat. Again he had been asked where his place was, and again his answer, "Where I am needed," was unsatisfactory. He toiled over another pointless task, driving nails into a thick sheet of wool, which let them fall through to the floor, where he picked them up and drove them through again. His reconsideration of the last question he had been asked was interrupted when the door behind him opened and his guide motioned for him to follow. They moved through long passages, winding their way up to the level where they would eat the scant morning meal. When they entered the hall, the guide took a place by the door, while others in black robes similarly escorted the white-clad ones into the hall. This was the day that the young man's guide would stand and watch the boys in white, who, along with the young man, were bound to eat in silence. Each day a different wearer of the black robe filled this function. The young man ate and considered the last question of the morning. He weighed each possible answer, seeking out possible flaws, and as they were discovered, discarding them. Abruptly, one answer came unbidden to his mind, an intuitive leap, as his subconscious provided him with a solution to the question. "I am the architect of my own imprisonment." Several times in the past, when particularly knotty problems had stopped his progress, this had occurred, which accounted for his rapid advancement in his lessons. He weighed the possible flaws in this answer, and when he was certain he was correct, he stood. Other eyes regarded him furtively, for this was a violation of the rules. He went over to stand before his guide, who regarded his approach with a controlled expression, his only sign of curiosity being a slight arching of his brows. Without preamble, the young man in white said, "This is no longer my place." The man in black showed no emotion, but placed a hand on the young man's shoulder and nodded slightly. He reached inside his robe and removed a small bell, which he rang once. Another black-robed individual appeared moments later. Without word, the newcomer took the place at the door as the guide motioned for the young man to follow him. They walked in silence as they had done many times before until they came to a room. The man in black turned to the young man and said, "Open the door." The young man started to reach for the door, then, with a flash of insight, pulled his hand away. Knitting his brow in concentration, he opened the door by the power of his mind. Slowly it swung inward. The man in black turned and smiled. "Good," he said in a soft, pleasant voice. They entered a room with many white, grey, and black robes hanging upon hooks. The man in black said, "Change to a grey robe." The young man did so quickly and faced the other man. The man in black studied the new wearer of the grey. "You are no longer bound to silence. Any question you may have will be answered, as well as is possible, though there are still things that will be waited upon until you don the black. Then you will fully understand. Come." The young man in grey followed his guide to another room, where cushions surrounded a low table, upon which rested a pot of hot chocha, a pungent, bittersweet drink. The man in black poured two cups and handed one to the young man, indicating he should sit. They both sat, and the young man said, "Who am I?" The man in black shrugged. "You will have to decide that, for only you can glean your true name. It is a name that must never be spoken to others, lest they gain power over you. Henceforward, you will be called Milamba." The newly named Milamba thought for a moment, then said, "It will serve. What are you called?" "I am called Shimon." "Who are you?" "Your guide, your teacher. Now you will have others. But it was given to me to be responsible for the first part of your training, the longest part." "How long have I been here?" "Nearly 4 years." Milamba was surprised by this, for his memory stretched back only a little, several months at best. "When will my memories be returned to me?" Shimon smiled, for he was pleased that Milamba had not asked if they would be returned, and said as much. "Your mind will call up your past life as you progress in the balance of your training, slowly at first, with more rapidity later. There is a reason for this. You must be able to withstand the lure of former ties, of family and nations, of friends and home. In your case, that is particularly vital." "Why is that?" "When your past returns to you, you will understand," was all Shimon said, a smile on his face. His hawkish features and dark eyes were set in an expression that communicated the feeling this was the end of that topic. Milamba thought of several questions, quickly discarding them as of less immediate consequence. Finally he asked, "What would have happened if I had opened the door by hand?" "You would have died." Shimon said this flatly, without emotion. Milamba was not surprised or shocked. He simply accepted it. "To what end?" Shimon was a little surprised by the question and showed it. "We cannot rule each other. All we can do is ensure that each new magician is able to discharge the responsibility attendant upon his actions."
You made the judgment that your place was no longer with those who wore the white, the novices. If that was not your place, then you would have to demonstrate your ability to deal with the responsibilities of this change. The bright but foolish ones often die at this stage. Melamba considered this and acknowledged the propriety of such a test. How long will my training continue? Shimon made a noncommittal gesture. As long as it takes. You rise rapidly, however, so I think it will not be too much longer in your case. You have certain natural gifts, and you will understand this when your memory returns, a certain advantage over the other younger students who started with you. Melamba studied the contents of his cup. In the thin, dark fluid, he seemed to glimpse a single word, as if seen from the corner of the eye, that vanished when he tried to focus upon it. He couldn't hang on to it, but it had been a short name, a simple name. That night he dreamed again. The man in brown walked along the road, and this time Melamba could follow. You see, there are few objective limits. What they teach you is useful, but never accept the proposition that just because a solution satisfies a problem, that it must be the only solution. The man in brown stopped. Look at this, he said, pointing to a flower beside the road. Melamba leaned down to see what the man was pointing at. A small spider spun a web between two leaves. That creature, said the man in brown, toils oblivious to our passing. Either of us could crush out its existence at whim. Consider this, then. If that creature could somehow apprehend our existence, our threat to its life, would the spider worship us? I don't know, Melamba answered. I don't know how a spider thinks. The man in brown leaned upon his staff. Considering how little humans think alike, it might be that this spider would react with fear, defiance, indifference, fatalism, or incredulity. Anything's possible. He reached out with his staff and gently caught a piece of spider silk on the wooden pole. Lifting the tiny arachnid, he transported it over to the opposite side of the road. Do you think the creature knows that this is a different flower? I don't know. The man in brown smiled. That is perhaps the wisest of all answers. Returning to his walk, he said, You will be seeing many things soon, some of which will make little sense to you. When you do, remember one thing. What is that? Asked Melamba. Things are not always what they seem. Remember the spider, who at this very moment may be offering prayers to me in thanks for its sudden bounty. Pointing back with a staff at the plant, he said, There are a great many more bugs on that one than the other. Scratching at his beard, he added, I wonder, is the flower also offering prayers of thanks? He spent weeks in the company of Shimon and a few others. He knew more of his life, though only a fragment of what was missing. He had been a slave, and he had been discovered to have the power. He remembered a woman and felt a faint tugging at the thought of her vaguely remembered image. He was quick to learn. Each lesson was accomplished in a single day, or at most two. He would quickly dissect each problem given, and when it was time to discuss it with his teachers, his questions were to the point, well thought out, and proper. One day he arose, in a newer but still simple cell, and emerged to find Shimon waiting for him. The black-robed magician said, From this point on, you may not speak until you have finished the task set for you. Melamba nodded his understanding and followed his guide down the hall.
The older magician led him through a series of long tunnels to a place in the building he had never been before. They mounted a long staircase, rising many stories above where they had started. Upward they climbed, until Shimon opened a door for him. Malamba preceded Shimon through the door and found himself upon an open flat roof, atop a high tower. From the center of the roof a single spire of stone rose. Skyward it shot, a needle of fashioned rock. Winding upward around it was a narrow stairway, carved into the side of the needle. Melamba's eyes followed it until the top was lost in the clouds. He found the sight fascinating, for it seemed to violate several canons of physical law that he had studied. Still, it stood before him, and what was more, his guide was indicating that he should mount the steps. He started upward. As he completed his first circumnavigation, he noted that Shimon had disappeared through the wooden door. Relieved of his presence, Melamba turned his gaze outward from the roof, drinking in the vista around him. He was atop the highest tower of an immense city of towers. Everywhere he looked, hundreds of stone fingers pointed upward, strong structures with windows turning blind eyes outward.